Chapter 14. Summers walked slowly from the sand toward the hotel lobby. He was spent. Drawn to the Hilton to visit with his memories, he had underestimated the pain. He would not come again. As he approached the lobby, he noticed a sign on the kiosk. Hawaii, a photographic essay, an island journey captured through the lens. Marcy Grant, artist, Rainbow Tower Lobby. Pictures available for purchase, 10 to 5. The lobby was crowded. The show appeared to be running successfully. Several framed prints rested on easels. Others were propped against the walls. Unframed prints, covered with acetate, were arranged in plastic crates. Marcy sat behind a table, cheerfully chatting with the tourists who were busily thumbing through the prints. With his hands clasped behind his back, Summers meandered around the room admiring the photos. Memories made him pause and stare at a picture of the Pali lookout.
"Are you going to buy that one, Jack?"
Marcy said from behind him. "You do very nice work."
"Thank you. The one you're looking at with the frame is only $250.
"If I buy this picture, will you have a cup of coffee with me?"
"No, you should buy a picture because you like it, not because you want me to have a cup of coffee with you. Besides, I won't let you buy the picture. I'll give it to you."
"I'd like to make amends for the other night."
"With a cup of coffee?" "Pretty cheap amends." "I thought you said it was better for us not to be seen together."
"That's probably true. But I've had a real bad day. Besides, I'm still ashamed of myself. The other night was totally out of character for me." Marcy laughed hard.
"Not entirely. I seem to remember the six of us sitting in your living room getting quite shit-faced when you closed your first merger."
Jack smiled. "Everyone except Alina."
"That's right, of course. She didn't drink. But I was sure drunk enough for the two of us." "You have nothing to apologize for."
A woman's loud laughter and the sound of broken wood quickly grabbed Marcy's attention. She spun around to see a large man in a bathing suit and a tank top lying on top of framed pictures and broken easels. His tropical drink had spilled all over his shirt and Marcy's pictures. He was trying to control his amusement.
"Whoops," he slurred. "Guess I didn't see that stop sign, officer."
He and his girlfriend broke into sloppy belly laughter. He wiped his nose with the back of his hand.
"You know, lady," he said to Marcy, "you shouldn't have all those fucking pictures lying around the floor for people to trip on, you know? It's a fucking hazard."
"You're right, Randy,"
his girlfriend said.
"We should sue this stupid hotel."
"Right, baby."
Then to Marcy said,
"You owe me $14 for a tequila sunrise. It's practically full. I only had a sip or two."
"Oh, you?"
Marcy said angrily.
"You broke four of my frame 16x20s. At $450 a piece. That's $1,800.
Randy stood and puffed out his chest.
"I want to pay 18 cents for this shit. I want $14 for my drink or I'll take it out of your cash box."
He pushed Marcy aside and moved toward the table. Jack blocked his advance and, without thinking, nailed him flush with a hard right cross. Randy stumbled backward, falling onto the stairs.
"Down goes Randy,"
his girlfriend said, laughing. Randy scrambled to his feet and bull-rushed Jack, forcing him back through the doors of the lobby and onto the floor, where two security guards finally separated them.
"Fucking guy cheap-shotted me," Randy said, rubbing his jaw.
"This is the second time we've had a problem with you, Mr. Webster. You need to find another hotel, now." The security guards walked him out to the front desk, one on each side. Jack returned to the lobby, where Marcy was salvaging what remained of the broken pictures. The hotel staff was picking up broken glass. The lobby had been cleared of customers.
"Are you okay, Jack?"
Marcy pointed to his chest.
"Your shirt is ripped."
Jack shrugged.
"I guess so."
"What were you doing? Are you crazy? That guy was twice your size."
"He was a jerk. And he picked the wrong day to fuck with me."
Jack looked down at the mess, shook his head, and bent down to pick up a couple of pictures. Marcy leaned over and gave Jack a simple kiss on the cheek.
"If you wait a few minutes while I pack up, I'll have that cup of coffee with you."
Jack smiled. And when he did, He grimaced at the mouse growing under his right eye.
As they wheeled the cart with their stacked pictures toward the parking lot, Marcy looked at Jack and liltingly mimicked, "Down goes Randy."
They laughed.
"Actually, Jack, I'd prefer something stronger than a cup of coffee."
"I wasn't going to suggest that for obvious reasons."
"It's okay. Let's put these away and go back to the tiki bar."
Jack shook his head.
"I don't want to stay here. I've had enough of the Hilton for today. Can we go somewhere else?"
Chapter 15. The dinner plates were cleared and the dessert cart appeared. Catherine shook her head and ordered coffee.
"Tell me the rest of the story," she said to Liam.
Liam pointed at the cart.
"What about the cannoli? Aren't you gonna have cannoli? Sorrento's makes the best."
"You have it. I want to hear the story."
"Two cannoli, please," Liam said to the server.
"I don't want cannoli," Catherine said.
"We always have them. You might change your mind."
"No, I won't. You always order two cannoli, and I never eat mine."
"Okay, so then we'll take it home. But you might change your mind."
"The story."
"Okay. Jack and Alina fly to Chicago, Jack's hometown. They rent a place on Roscoe while Jack interviews for an attorney's position. In a few weeks, he lands a job at J&F in the transactional department. Meanwhile, Alina finds work teaching piano while she takes classes to be a social worker. All in all, Sharon describes quite the love story. Summers is totally devoted to Alina and she to him. Although Alina had never been to the U.S., she's very social. She finds things for them to do together. She's a musician, so of course they attend concerts. They subscribe to the Lyric Opera, and she gets Jack involved in the Chicago Shakespeare Theater.
Shakespeare? They're actors?
Liam shook his head. "Nah, they just like Shakespeare. Apparently, that was Alina's passion. She studied it in college. In Jordan. Go figure. In fact, they had a plaque hanging on their living room wall with a Shakespeare quote. She told Sharon it defined the moment that she and Jack decided to take the plunge."
"Really? What was on the plaque?"
Liam shook his head.
Quote from Julius Caesar about the tide in the affairs of men."
Catherine smiled.
"Of course. It would define the moment they decided to disobey the father and run away. If I'm not mistaken, it goes, 'There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries.' I think I'm getting a pretty good idea of who Alina was."
"You know that quote? Word for word?"
"You're too easily impressed. It's not obscure. Tell me the rest of the story."
"Well, Alina was looking for ways to build a social life in Chicago and came across the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. That was something they could do together and meet people. She became a board member."
Catherine shook her head.
"I've never been to Chicago Shakespeare Theater, and I've lived here all my life. She comes from Jordan, and within weeks, she ends up on the board." "That's pretty cool."
"You think that's cool?"
"Every year, Jack and Alina would hold a Shakespeare-themed party. All the board members would come dressed as their favorite characters. Sharon described one of their parties where Alina was Cleopatra and Jack was Mark Antony. Sharon dressed up as Brutus, which was pretty funny if you saw Sharon, a skinny little redhead. Sharon said it was so cute how they were always quoting Shakespeare. Anyway, back to the important stuff. Jack and Alina bought a little brick bungalow up in Logan Square, and 6 years ago they had a little girl. They named her Sophie."
"After Sophia?"
"Could be. Makes sense."
Liam took a small picture out of his pocket and handed it to Catherine.
"This is a copy of a picture that sits on Summers' desk. Alina and Sophie are standing with him on a beach."
"What a pretty family."
"She's lovely, and the child is precious. Look at that smile.
Where are they, in Brazil?"
"Could be, but I don't think so. I don't think he ever went to Brazil, then or now, and I'll tell you why in a few minutes."
"You're getting to the sad part, aren't you?"
Liam nodded. "Until a couple years ago, everything went fine. Sharon says they were the quintessential American family. Her words, wonderful friends and neighbors. She described a very close neighborhood group of friends. Then, about a year and a half ago, Alina got word from Sophia that her mother had suffered a heart attack. She was in critical condition and was scheduled for open-heart surgery. Alina tells Jack, 'I've got to go back.'"
"Had Alina been in touch with her parents during any of this time?"
Catherine said.
"Only with her mother, but secretly.
Her father had disowned her. When she snuck out of Jordan with Jack, he washed his hands of her. To him, she didn't exist anymore. Alina would send letters and pictures, especially of Sophie, but her father never acknowledged them. Her mother would send private notes to Sophia, who would forward them to Alina. Her father never knew. Catherine shook her head.
I can't imagine. How does a man disown his daughter? And how does a daughter deal with that pain?
Sharon could tell you. She spent many a night consoling Alina, who loved her father and suffered through tremendous guilt. She begged him in her letters to accept her family and reestablish a relationship, but he never answered. Sophia said that he forbade Alina's name from being spoken in the home.
Defies comprehension.
Liam nodded. So, Alina goes back to Amman. Jack stays behind with Sophie.
Wasn't Alina afraid to return? I mean, her father kept her prisoner. How could she risk going back?
She had to chance it. Alina leaves in June, a year and a half ago. She's gone a month, first to Amman, where the surgery takes place, and then back to her parents' home in the West Bank to help her mother recover. She stays with her mother until July, and only returns to Chicago when her mother is up and about.
What about the father?
Her father was distant to her, but not imperious. Again, Sharon's words. He spoke to her from a distance. He'd look at her and shake his head in disapproval. He never asked about Jack or Sophie. Any conversation between the two of them focused on Alina's mother and the care she needed. But Alina told Sharon that toward the end of the visit, she thought his demeanor was softening. Right before she left, Alina saw a framed picture of Sophie sitting on the mantel. She looked at her father, right into his eyes, and he acknowledged her. He nodded with a little bit of a smile. Alina thought that was a big break in the ice.
So then Alina returned home to Jack?
Liam nodded. But she was not well. Sharon told me that when Alina returned, she looked a little thin and sickly, which was unusual for Alina. She was a healthy woman, very fit. Shannon figured Alina was exhausted, but that wasn't it. Apparently, she had picked up something on her trip. In her weakened condition, she began to run a fever and she couldn't shake it. One afternoon, Sharon called Jack at the office and told him to come home. Alina needs to see a doctor right away, Sharon said. She can't hold her food down. Jack took her to Northwestern Memorial, where she was admitted and seen by a team of specialists. They pumped her full of antibiotics and fluids and sent vials of her blood to infectious disease centers. But the disease was very aggressive. Despite their care, she wasn't getting any better. Jack practically moved into the hospital. Sophie stayed with Sharon. Doctors tried everything, but Sharon said it was like trying to hold a handful of water. No matter what they did, she just kept slipping through their fingers. Too much damage had been done. Then she started bleeding internally. 5 weeks after she returned home, Alina died. Jack was overwhelmed at the suddenness of the loss. In a moment, his life had changed. Nevertheless, he and Sophie did their best to carry on. They were great for each other. At Sharon's urging, Jack and Sophie attended some therapy sessions. That helped somewhat. Then he went back to work, and Sophie went back to preschool, and that helped as well. By Christmas, Jack was on his feet. It seemed like he and Sophie were standing on a stable platform. And then the second wave hit him. Catherine sat mesmerized.
What second wave?
Alina's parents came to Chicago and hired Fenton and Gibbs.
The divorce firm?
Right. They sued for guardianship, claiming that Jack was unfit, that Sophie's life was in danger, and that the best interests of Sophie would be served by a change of custody to the grandparents.
Was that true? Was Sophie's life endangered?
Not according to Sharon. She says Jack and Sophie were as close as any father-daughter she'd ever known. They went everywhere together. Sophie was very well adjusted and doing well in school. Catherine gestured for the waiter to bring another cup of coffee.
Cat, I paid the bill, said Liam.
Don't you want to go home?
Not until you've finished.
What about Jack's parents? Were they still alive?
No.
But Jack was not about to give up custody of Sophie to anyone. He hired Harold Fine.
Catherine nodded. Good hire.
The case lasted for months and was a nightmare of a legal battle, but in the end, Jack won. The grandparents' petition for guardianship was denied, and Jack retained sole custody of Sophie. The judge gave Alina's parents limited weekend visitation within the Chicago city limits.
and that ended up being the problem. One weekend they came, took the child, and never returned. Jack called their hotel and was told they had checked out. He called the police, the FBI, there was an Amber Alert. Liam shook his head and shrugged his shoulders. Gone. Catherine leaned forward. Did anyone find out what happened? Nope. Speculation only. I think it's a safe bet they're back in the Middle East. Can't the State Department get her back? Not from where they are. I know there's some law on international child abduction, but I doubt that the Palestinian Authority is a signatory. You would know better than I. Jack made several inquiries through diplomatic channels with no success. Anyway, all this happened a couple months ago. Then this Kelsen deal came up, and now both Jack and the $88 million are gone. And you don't think Jack's in Brazil? Could be, but it doesn't make a lot of sense. Jack wants his daughter. He needs to mount a plan to get her back. How does he do that from exile in Brazil? By himself. I don't know. It doesn't fit the story. What fits the story? Liam raised a finger. The Taggart hypothesis? Brazil's a clever diversion. I think he wants us to believe he's in Brazil, but he's really somewhere else. He's got the money and he's planning to use it to finance Sophie's rescue. If he's not in Brazil, then where is he? I don't have a clue. Someplace where he can hide out and raise Sophie. Maybe he's still in Chicago. Catherine stood. What's the next step? Liam helped her with her coat. Keep asking questions. Keep poking around. Something'll come up. It always does.
Chapter 16. Sophie sat at her desk and stared out the window of her bedroom. Her chin was cradled in her palm. The outbuilding to the side of the house was going through its shift change. Three times a day, workers would come and go from the building. Sophie wondered what was in the building. Why was there so much activity? But Jody would not let her go there. "You are forbidden," he told her sternly. She ambled over to her closet. It was full of strange new clothes that Giada had hung there. She didn't like them. She wanted to wear the clothes that she and her mother had picked out together. Colorful, fun clothes. It was warm most days in Hebron, but there were no short sets, no t-shirts, no pink Nikes. There were white blouses with sleeves that buttoned at the wrist, which she had to wear with ankle-length skirts, and long dresses from the neck to the shin, and the long, heavy coats that Giada called jilbabs. Those were the uniforms for madrasa. She didn't belong in those clothes. She didn't belong in this bedroom. She belonged in her own house. Why couldn't she go there?
"Come here, my little one. Come,"
Al-Zahani called from the other room. He sat in his large wingback chair and patted his lap.
"Come sit and have a cup of chocolate."
Sophie, her head lowered slightly, walked to her grandfather and stood beside him. He reached down and lifted her onto his lap.
"And how was school today?"
Sophie slowly shook her head from side to side.
"I am told that one of the little girls, Jamila, has invited you to play at her home tomorrow. Yes?"
Sophie nodded.
"We're going to paint pictures."
"That is good. You will have many friends here in Hebron, I promise you."
Al-Zahani turned to a side table, lifted his silver filigreed pitcher, and poured warm chocolate into a demitasse cup. He offered it to Sophie, who took it with both hands.
"Thank you, Jody,"
she said softly.
"You know, my precious one, we have many friends in our city. We are a proud family here. We are known here for many, many years. I can trace my ancestors, my great-great-great-grandfathers, all the way back to the land of Canaan. Do you know of Canaan?"
Sophie raised her eyes from her cup. She shook her head.
"I will tell you, because they are your great-great-great-grandfathers as well."
Al-Zahani smiled and kissed her on the forehead.
Many, many years ago, thousands of years ago, our ancestors lived peacefully in the valleys of Canaan, in the middle of Palestine. In this very area, here in the mountains of Hebron, lived the people known as Hittites. They were descended from Heth, the second son of Canaan. And you know what? So am I. And so are you. We are also descendants of the great warrior Heth. And you know how I know this? With wide-eyed curiosity, Sophie shook her head. Because when I was just a small boy, no older than you, my blessed grandfather Ibrahim sat me on his lap with a cup of chocolate, the same as you and I are today, and told me the glories of our ancestors. We are proud Canaanites, Sophie. Do not ever forget that. Once, there were seven nations of Canaan, and they all dwelt peacefully in these lands. Until... He stopped and pointed his finger. Until the Israelites were sent to wipe them out.
Who sent them?
Sophie said. Ah, child, it's all in the Bible. No doubt you are too young to have studied the Bible, but it is in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 7. The Israelites are commanded to smite all the people in the seven tribes of Canaan. They say that God commanded them and said to them, "Thou shalt have no pity upon them." But I ask you, what good and loving God would command such a thing? Sophie shrugged. It was at that time that one of the spies of Moses... Do you know of Moses?
Sophie nodded.
Oh, of course your father must have told you the Jewish stories of Moses. Well, Moses sent one of his spies, Joshua, to explore the lands of Canaan. After Moses died, Joshua became the leader of a massive army, and with thousands and thousands of Israelites, he invaded the lands of the Jordan Valley to settle his people. The peaceful people of Ammon were not fighters. They did not have the weapons of Joshua's army. But they were proud, and told Joshua he cannot have their land. They tried to defend their homes, but Joshua conquered them, and showed no mercy. After conquering Ammon and leaving no person alive, Joshua and his people did not even settle there. No, they went north to conquer more of Canaan. Again, my precious, the peaceful people of Canaan had attacked no one. They threatened no one. They only wished to be left alone to live on their land. But the Israelites and their ruthless armies marched north to fight against them.
Why, Jadi? Why did the Israelites want to fight?
They say in their Bible that God commanded them. But in truth, that is their way. They are conquerors and occupiers of other people's houses and lands. Even today, just the same. Did you ever hear the simple song, "Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho"?
Sophie's eyes brightened.
And the walls came tumbling down.
Just so. Only the song is a fable. We are not told the real story. Do you want to know?
Sophie nodded.
Jericho, the oldest city in the world, was a peaceful little village in Canaan. It was small, but it had a large wall around the city to protect the people. Jericho didn't have very many soldiers, only about 500. Joshua had a huge army of 8,000 Israelites, some on horses, some on foot, but all with weapons. There were four times as many men in Joshua's army as there were all the people in the town of Jericho. But the people had built a wall 6 feet thick and 26 feet high, so they felt safe.
Like the wall around your house, Jadi?
Al-Zahani laughed.
Maybe. Only a little bigger than mine. No?
How did the walls come tumbling down?
That is only a fairy story. The truth is that Joshua and his army encircled the city, and for 6 days marched around making terrible noise and blowing loud horns. Then, a woman named Rahab, a very evil woman who thought only of herself, made a secret deal with Joshua. In exchange for her safety, she snuck Joshua's soldiers into the town and they opened the gates for the army. What happened next is too terrible to tell. The Canaanites who lived in Jericho were brave and honorable, but no match for such a large army. After Joshua finished fighting them, he set the whole town on fire. Then he marched on to fight other towns in Canaan.
And our family comes from Canaan, Jadi?
Al-Zahani nodded. For thousands of years, even though their lands were taken and they were left to wander without a home, they struggled against their oppressors and resisted the unlawful occupation then, as we do now.
Did you ever have to leave your home?
Yes, I did. My whole family, my friends, and everyone I knew had to flee from the bombs. I was just about your age. We lived in Haifa, by the ocean.
Did you have a home like mine?
Well, I've never been inside your home, but I think they were probably very much alike. I had my own bedroom.
Why did you leave your home?
Because a war was about to start. Because far, far away from us, in New York City, a group of other countries decided to split up the land of Palestine and take our part away from us and give it to the Jews for a new country called Israel. So that we could keep our families safe from the war, we had to flee from our home, and we could never come back.
That's not fair.
You are right, little one. It is not fair. Al-Zahani lifted Sophie from his lap and kissed her on the forehead. And now, it is time for bed. Chapter 17. Large snowflakes, illuminated by the headlights of Kelson's black Bentley, gave the illusion of space travel as it motored through the streets of a quiet subdivision north of Chicago. The Bentley turned into a driveway at the end of a cul-de-sac and flashed its high beams against the side of the house. A figure soon emerged, dressed in a black, hooded parka. He sloshed through the snow to the back of the Bentley and a window was lowered. The man leaned in. He spoke with a Russian accent.
Is it all arranged?
Yes, Kelson said.
You're sure? Dmitri will be playing large. This must be assured, nothing can go wrong.
The man wagged his finger side to side.
Nothing is assured, Yevgeny.
It's a basketball game, things can go wrong. Tell Dmitri to lay off if he's worried.
Dmitri wants to know. Are you in?
Big time.
Okay. Then I give you this. You better be right.
Yevgeny passed an envelope through the window. Kelson held the envelope by the window.
Don't give me any of that better be right crap.
I did what I had to do. Either he wants this money played or he doesn't.
He wants it played.
Kelson counted the bills. He nodded and raised the window. Dan Gibson received a call just after dinner. The doorman in the Trump lobby informed him that two policemen wanted to come up and talk to him. Gibson opened the door when they arrived. Detective O'Haron spoke, his head lowered slightly.
I'm afraid I have bad news for you, sir. Mr. Harrington's body was found this evening at the Fullerton Breakwater.
Gibson's legs went wobbly and he sat down on the couch.
What happened?
Well, sir, it looks like there's been foul play. There was a bullet wound. His body was taken to the medical examiner's. You can see him there, sir, if you want to. Are you okay?
No, I'm not okay. Would you be okay?
Gibson's chin quivered.
Where was the wound?
O'Haron hesitated.
In his right temple.
Gibson grabbed his face with both hands and cried. O'Haron pulled a small writing pad from his back pocket.
Can we ask a few questions?
Gibson swallowed hard.
Can we do this tomorrow?
Sure. That'd be all right. We'll call you tomorrow. But can I ask just one question? Just one or two?
Gibson nodded. O'Haron pulled up a chair opposite the couch and sat on the edge.
Was Mr. Harrington depressed recently? Were there any, what they call, suicidal ideations? Would he take his own life?
Gibson sobbed.
No. Never. We were so happy. His company was just sold and we were going to take a vacation. Denny's idea, a cruise through the Panama Canal.
Gibson grabbed a tissue.
Did you find a gun?
O'Haron shook his head and penciled a few notes.
If his company was sold, where was he going to work?
We have some savings. Then he could easily get another job if he wants one. He's very good at what he does.
Gibson caught himself.
At what he did.
I'm truly sorry, sir. Do you know whether he had money troubles? Was he indebted to anyone?
I told you we have savings,
Gibson snapped.
And besides, he told me he was getting a substantial bonus on the sale of the company.
Excuse me for asking this, sir, but with him dead and all, would he still get that bonus?
Gibson shook his head.
I don't know. It's not something we ever discussed. Would you leave now, please?
Of course.
O'Haron stood and took a step toward the door, then stopped.
Just one more question, please. Did he have any enemies?
Gibson shook his head.
Anybody would want to do him harm.
Gibson shook his head.
Excuse me for asking this, but did he have any other relationships? You know, other guys who would, be jealous enough to be violent?
That's insulting. Now please leave.
Very sorry, sir. Can we call you tomorrow?
Gibson nodded and showed them out. Chapter 18. Marcy smiled over the rim of her wine glass. They sat side by side at a plank table on the veranda of Paka's Seaside Sushi Shack. Her elbows rested on the table, and she wrapped her hands around the glass.
You are so gallant.
That was not my intent.
I assure you, it was all knee-jerk.
Jack gazed out at the Pacific. The stars on the horizon were both discernible in the minutes following the sun's dip beneath the edge of the earth, known to sailors as nautical twilight. The sea moved in shadows, swells and white caps.
'Twas gallantry nonetheless. I choose to believe my version of the story. Reasonable minds can differ. Isn't that what you lawyers say?
Marcy took a deep, relaxing breath and stared at the ocean.
This reminds me of that weekend at Grand Haven. Remember? We were all sitting at a picnic table on the beach. Must have been midnight, but Sophie wasn't the least bit sleepy. She kept running through the sand, chasing fireflies.
Marcy chuckled.
What a sight. Alina chasing after her, trying to slow her down. They had quite a bond, those two.
Summers was silent. His lips quivered.
Jack, I'm sorry. Should I not bring up the past? There were such good times.
He nodded.
I'm okay. Let's talk about you.
Oh, now there's an interesting subject. Struggling photographer trying to make ends meet in one of the country's most expensive locations. I used to think Ted did me a favor chasing me out of Chicago, but now I think I bit off more than I can chew. I'm not even sure where I'll be living next week.
Pacific Properties?
How do you know about that?
The summons and complaint were sitting on the counter beside your coffee maker.
So you read them?
Nosy. She shook her head.
I'm getting evicted. Mr. Nakamura wants me out of the house, and he's been looking for an excuse. I was out of town on the first when the rent was due. I took it over to him on the third, but he wouldn't accept it.
2 days late? Did he serve you with any notices?
She shook her head.
He showed me a section of the lease that said if the rent wasn't paid on time, he would have the right to cancel the lease. It's right there in black and white.
How much time is left on the lease?
18 months.
but it looks like I'll have to find another place pretty quick. The court date is next Tuesday.
Have you talked to his lawyer?
He doesn't have one. He's a real estate man. He filed the papers by himself.
Jack nodded and smiled.
Jack, she said quietly. A few minutes ago, I didn't mean to upset you. You should cherish those memories of the good times. They're yours to keep. They're ours to keep. And to share with Sophie.
I know. He turned his head away to look at the ocean.
Jack, I'm worried about you. Alina's death was a heartbreaker for all of us, but most of all, you need to hold it together. You've got Sophie to raise. She needs you.
Jack stood suddenly.
Thanks, Marcy. I have to go. I'm sorry.
He put a $100 bill on the table and walked away.
Hello, Mr. Jenkins,
Catherine's receptionist said. She took his coat and offered a cup of coffee, which Jenkins accepted. He carried a large manila envelope. Moments later, she showed Jenkins into Catherine's office.
Here's the lawsuit.
He placed the envelope on her desk. She took out the pleading and skimmed through it while Jenkins sat quietly with his coffee. When she was finished reading, she said,
Who's your malpractice carrier and what's the coverage?
LNA, and it's $50 million exclusive of defense costs.
She nodded.
That leaves $38 million uninsured.
Who did LNA hire to defend you?
Alan Beaverton.
Catherine raised her eyebrows.
High-priced talent. Are you any closer to finding out what happened?
Jenkins set his cup down and sat back in his chair.
Well, it's pretty obvious. Someone engineered a theft of $88 million from the closing escrow and siphoned the money off to Panama. And from there, who knows where? Harrington and Summers both signed the wire instructions, and both are missing. Hard for me to believe that Summers did this to me. The firm was so good to him after his wife died.
And you feel you need an attorney for the deficiency?
Of course. Besides, and I know you don't believe me, but I've always thought you have extraordinary litigation skills. Your approach is incisive, intuitive. You see things that others do not. I've known that since the day we hired you. Please, Catherine, we're in a fix and I need the best. You can name your initial retainer, but I'm prepared to give you a check for $50,000 this afternoon.
Catherine stared into Jenkins' eyes.
All right, Walter. I'll take it on. I'd like a satellite office at J&F that I can use for this case.
Jenkins breathed a sigh of relief.
Done. And we've assigned Rob Hemmer to assist you. Anything you need.
I want access to Summers' personal file and any other files he maintained at J&F.
We've already pulled them. He has a file for the purchase of his house and a file, quite thick, for the custody dispute. There's really nothing in his personnel file, but I'll set the three files in your office. Then, of course, there's the Kelson file.
Catherine stood.
I'll come in tomorrow.
Chapter 19. The group of 10, the self-styled Sons of Canaan, met again in the back of the Breadstone Bakery. A short man in a black-on-green Palestinian keffiyeh rushed in out of breath, agitated.
You are late, Rami.
I think I was being followed.
I diverted my route and came through the rear of the butcher shop. I ran two blocks behind the square. I didn't see her again, but I can't be sure.
How do you know you were followed?
A woman was waiting when I left my building. She pretended to be texting on her cell phone, but when I started walking, what did she look like?
What did she look like?
She looked like any other woman in a burqa. But she held her cell phone sideways like she was taking a picture. I spotted her, and she turned her back.
Fakir, the bakery owner, lowered his head and put his hands on top of his knitted takia.
The IDF. They've discovered us. And my bakery. We'll have to abandon our project.
Stop panicking, Fakir. Rami is a frightened squirrel. There's no evidence that anything has been discovered.
Nizar said,
Who ever heard of IDF spies running around in burqas?
Nevertheless, I don't want to meet in my bakery again. We should meet at Arif's.
His privacy, a house with a wall around it.
Out of the question, Al-Zahani said. I want no attention drawn to my laboratories. There are to be no meetings at my home. Besides, my granddaughter is living with me.
The granddaughter. We hear too much of this American Jewess, said Nizar.
Al-Zahani jumped to his feet and took a step in Nizar's direction.
She is my blood, you cocksucker. The lineage of my ancestors runs through her bones. She traces her descent from the ancient Canaanites. You live in Hebron because my father liberated it. My father and my grandfather are icons to our people. They died for us. Can you say the same of your pig family?
Faiz interrupted.
Stop! What are you accomplishing? You insult his granddaughter and you call his family pigs? Are you both out of your minds? Did he not bring her from America? Is she not a Jew? We will have no more of this,
Faiz said.
We will not abandon our glorious plan. We will continue to meet. Fakir does not want us to meet here. Then we will meet somewhere else. We have much to do in the coming weeks. There is an empty apartment not far from here. I will arrange for Rami to rent it.
Maybe we should put off our meetings for a while, said Ahmed. If the IDF is looking for us, it jeopardizes the entire operation.
The IDF is not here. The Palestinian police patrol this area. The Israeli police are only in the H2. The IDF knows nothing of what we do,
Nizar said.
If we put off our meetings, then the entire operation is scuttled. Our target date is only 2 months away.
And we still do not have sufficient quantities, Al-Zahani said. We will need every bit of 2 months.
Then we meet at the apartment on Monday.
Chapter 20.
Old, familiar territory for Catherine as she walked the hallways of Jenkins and Fairchild. Bittersweet. It looked the same. Not much had changed. 2 years ago, she had considered it a secure, comfortable place to be, only to abruptly learn that the firm valued pandering to clients more than moral imperatives, forcing her to tender her resignation. But she felt no regrets, quite the opposite. Her present practice was far more satisfying. No intra-firm politics, no pandering to influential clients. Staff members smiled and welcomed her back as she made her way to her assigned satellite office, a large windowed room overlooking the Federal Plaza on Adams Street. Several expandable folders were sitting on a credenza, the largest by far, being the matter labeled In Regards to the Guardianship of Sophie Summers. She would save that for last. She picked up Summers' personnel file and thumbed through the contents. Application for employment, tax forms, health insurance forms, and yearly self-evaluation letters written to the JNF Compensation Committee. The first several letters were unremarkable. They recited his successful handling of certain mergers and acquisitions. As the years progressed, he assumed more of the responsibilities in the business and transactional group. 4 years ago, he was elevated to practice group chairman. In the last couple years, since his wife's death, the file reflected long absences and multiple requests for medical and family leave. Yet, as Walter said, the firm was good to him. His compensation was not reduced. His most recent self-evaluations were short and apologetic. He was sorry for his inattention to the practice. He vowed to do better. The last few pages in the personnel file referenced loans from his pension and profit-sharing accounts. These coincided with the period when Summers was defending the guardianship petition. From the size of the custody file alone, Catherine could surmise the enormity of the financial drain. Loans from the retirement account would have netted him $150,000. Summers's house purchase file held little of interest. The home was purchased 6 years ago for $325,000. It was titled to John Summers and Alina Summers, husband and wife, as tenants by the entirety. There was a second mortgage and a refinance for a total of $415,000 15 months ago, during and after the custody battle. The guardianship file consisted of four folders, each 4 or 5 inches thick. Catherine poured herself a cup of coffee and started at the beginning.
Petition for guardianship of Sophie Summers, a minor. She spent the rest of the day perusing the file, occasionally setting papers to the side for further review and copying. The Al-Zahani's guardianship petition was aggressive. It accused Jack of dangerously neglecting Sophie. It asserted that Jack had become so depressed over the death of Alina that he was unable to make day-to-day decisions or properly care for Sophie. "The miner's residence has become a dark and unhealthy tomb of despair," read the petition. "Continued residence in the home would be dangerous to the child's physical and mental well-being." On the other hand, the petitioners, Arif and Lubana Al-Zahani, are kind and loving grandparents who are capable of nourishing and providing for the care of the child. They have a warm and comfortable home. The best interests of the child would be served by granting guardianship to the Al-Zahanis. At the inception of the case, the Al-Zahanis filed an emergency motion for an immediate change of custody. It was supported by the affidavits of two private investigators, with a picture of Summers sitting on his front porch, a beer bottle by his side, dabbing his eyes with a tissue. The motion accused Summers of diving into alcohol and drugs. It was obvious the petitioners were pulling out all the stops. The affidavit stated that women were coming and going into the home at all hours of the day and night. Grainy pictures were attached showing women entering the front door, time-stamped 1 a.m. and 2:30 a.m. The motion continued, "On one occasion when staying in rustic temporary quarters because his electricity was shut off, Summers left the child all alone in the middle of the night without any adult supervision." Judge Carr set the emergency motion for an immediate hearing, acknowledging serious allegations. Summers' attorney, Harold Fine, asked the court for a short continuance to take discovery and investigate the charges, but the request was denied, and a hearing was set for the very next day. A transcript of the hearing was in the file. Though it was not a lengthy hearing, to Catherine it clearly indicated how much dirt the Al-Zahanis were willing to throw, and how far they were willing to bend the truth to win their case. The first witness was the private investigator who had followed Jack surreptitiously for several weeks. He attested to the photographs and his statement that the child had been left alone at some rustic wooden dwelling. He also testified that Sophie was at home when the various female subjects were coming and going into the home at all hours of the night. The direct testimony was damaging, and Jack's attorney needed a strong cross-examination to rebut the inferences of neglect. He began his cross by asking the investigator exactly when he was hired by the Al-Zahanis. 9 weeks ago, he answered. "And all during that time," Fine said, "as you were hired to do, would you take careful note of any activities you thought might be important to your clients in their custody case? Basically, if you saw something you thought was not in the best interest of the child, you would write it down, wouldn't you?"
"Yes."
"Or take a picture?"
"Yes."
"Like the pictures you attached to your affidavits?"
"That's right."
"Anything you thought was wrong?"
"Correct."
"And you took this picture because you thought it was wrong to be drinking a beer on the porch?"
"I thought it was wrong for the man to be drunk when his child was at home."
"Did you talk to Mr. Summers?"
"Of course not. We were doing covert surveillance."
"So you didn't know if he was slurring his speech or not?"
"I couldn't hear him, counsel."
"Did you take any pictures of him falling down?"
"I'm not sure. Not that I recall at this time."
"Not that you recall?" "You mean you might have taken a picture of him falling down drunk, a picture that would be very important to your clients in this case, but it might have slipped your mind? Maybe you forgot to bring it with you today?"
"No. I don't think I saw him fall down."
"How far away were you when you took this picture?"
"We were on the next block. We have a high-powered telephoto lens."
"How many pictures did you take of Mr. Summers in a beer bottle?"
"Not certain, but I sure took that one."
"In 9 weeks?"
"Yeah, so?"
"Well, I thought you told me you were going to take pictures every time you saw him do something wrong."
"Yeah."
"And that's the only one with alcohol?"
"That's the only one I brought to court."
"Are there others?"
"Maybe. I can't remember."
Fine grabbed a court-stamped document. "I'm going to show you a document entitled Petitioner's Response to Request the Production of Documents. I direct your attention to page 2 in paragraph 5. There's a list of all the pictures that the Al-Zahanis or their attorneys have.
Would you take a look at it?
The investigator looked at the paper, shrugged, and laid it down.
Okay, so I guess there are no other pictures of him holding alcohol.
Let's talk about the various female subjects. How many pictures of women coming and going from Mr. Summers' home did you produce out of your 9 weeks of covert surveillance?
6.
Who were the women?
How would I know? Why don't you ask your client?
Thank you, that's an excellent idea, and I will do that just as soon as we're finished. But getting back to my question, when you signed your affidavit, did you have any idea who any of these women were?
At 2 or 3 in the morning? What's the difference? Are you going to tell me that's a babysitter?
No, I'm going to tell you that's his sister.
There are different female subjects, counselor.
How many different women, sir? Take a look at your pictures.
It appears that there are at least 2.
At least?
There are 2.
So, in your 9 weeks of covert surveillance, you took 6 pictures of 2 different women going into Mr. Summers' home.
In the middle of the night.
On how many different nights?
2.
And in 9 weeks of covert surveillance, that's all you've got, right? 6 pictures taken on 2 nights.
And the beer bottle, counsel.
Fine held up a pointed finger and smiled. And the beer bottle. Thank you for reminding me. So that's all that Dr. Al-Zahani got out of the 9 weeks of covert surveillance?
No, counsel. When the subject's electricity was shut off, he went to a one-room dwelling and left his daughter alone at 11 at night.
You're absolutely right. I forgot about the dwelling. The electricity was turned off, you say. Did he forget to pay his bill?
No idea, counsel.
Had there been a storm?
I don't remember.
Was the electricity out in the neighborhood that night?
I don't work for the electric company.
The investigator must have chuckled at a smart remark, Catherine thought, because Judge Carr interjected,
"The court will admonish the witness. There is no cause for levity here."
This one-room dwelling that Mr. Summers and his daughter went to, was it a cabin up in the Wisconsin Dells?
Yep.
Is that a water park vacation area about 4 hours away?
Correct.
And you went all the way up there to take pictures?
That was my assignment.
24 hours a day?
Practically. Me or Frankie.
When he left Sophie alone in the cabin, where did he go?
How should I know? You mean, you didn't follow him? No.
You noted the time he left. Did you note the time he returned?
No.
How long was he gone?
Not exactly sure.
You didn't see him return, did you?
No.
Did you fall asleep?
It's possible. I can't recall.
Was Dr. Al-Zahani paying you by the hour?
Yeah.
In 9 weeks of work, how many hours did you log?
483.
How much were you paid per hour?
100 and a quarter. Fine jotted down a couple of figures.
So, for his $60,375, Dr. Al-Zahani got these 7 pictures?
I guess you could say that.
Nothing further?
Catherine smiled. Fine's cross was thorough and precise. He had not only damaged the investigator's credibility, but he had deftly created a platform for Summers to explain the accusations.
Summers then testified that one of the women was indeed his sister, and the other was his wife's best friend Sharon, who had been over for dinner, left her purse, and had come back to retrieve it at 12:45.
Sophie and Jack had gone to the Wisconsin Dells when a storm had knocked out the neighborhood's electricity.
Summers' momentary absence was due to a noisy toilet in the cabin. He thought he would wake Sophie, so he stepped outside behind the cabin to relieve himself. He was gone for less than 5 minutes.
As to the remaining picture, Summers admitted to sitting on his front porch having a beer. Sophie was at a friend's.
At the conclusion of the testimony, the judge denied the Al-Zahani's his emergency motion, but expressed his concern for the welfare of the child. He appointed an attorney to represent Sophie. He also appointed a social service agency to do a home study, and he scheduled the case for trial. After many other pretrial hearings, interrogatories, and depositions, ultimately at trial, both sides offered testimony from psychiatrists and childcare experts. Home visits had been made, including a report from a social agency in Hebron. Catherine estimated Summers' fees probably ran upward of $200,000. The transcripts of the trial were lengthy, and she copied them and headed for home. Chapter 21. Al-Zahani knocked softly on Sophie's bedroom door and opened it without waiting for a response. Sophie was at her desk. A school book was open, and she was practicing her writing.
Jadi, I can't learn Arabic. It's too hard. The letters are too hard to make.
They were hard for me too when I was your age. They're hard for everyone. But we all learn.
Jadi, I don't want to learn. I want to go home.
Jada said you played at Jamila's house today. Did you have fun?
Sophie nodded.
She's nice.
Her father is also a doctor, and her older sister will be married later this year. Jada says that you and Jamila can play here next week. Maybe you can play the piano for her.
Sophie shook her head.
Jamila's nice and her mother's nice to me, but I miss my home in Chicago. I miss my daddy. Why can't I go home?
Al-Zahani sat on the bed and patted the quilt.
Come sit here, my precious, and I will tell you why.
Sophie climbed up on her bed and crossed her legs.
This will be hard for you to hear. I did not want to tell you. It might make you sad, but I will tell you because I think you should know. You cannot go home, little one, because there is no home for you in Chicago anymore. My people back in Chicago have told me that your daddy has gone. No one knows where he went.
No,
Sophie cried.
He would not leave without me. You're lying. He would never leave me. I know where my home is. It's at 3814 Logan Boulevard. There's a red brick house there with a wooden chair in the front porch. It's my home.
There is no one in the home. Your father has left you and everyone else, and no one knows where he is.
You're lying,
she cried. She beat her fists upon his chest.
I want my daddy. I want to call him.
Al-Zahani gently held her wrists.
Sophie, I would never lie to you. Your daddy would never lie to you. Come with me and I will prove it to you.
He led her by the hand down the hall to a room he used as an office. He lifted her onto a desk chair and moved the telephone close to her.
Do you know your home phone number?
Sophie nodded. Through her sniffles, she said,
It's 1-312-555-3799.
Al-Zahani pushed the speaker button and dialed the number. It rang and the recorded message said, The number you have dialed has been disconnected. No further information is available.
I'm sorry,
Al-Zahani said quietly. Sophie hung her head and sobbed.
You remember when we were all in court, and you talked to the judge?
Sophie nodded.
Jada and I told the judge, we did not think your father would be able to take care of you. We wanted you to come here and live with us. And we were right. Your father did not take care of you. Now he has disappeared. He has no home, he has no phone. He's run off and no one knows where he is. And Sophie, he has never even called to ask about you. I'm so sorry.
That's not true.
She stuck out her chin.
He's a famous lawyer. I could call him at his office.
Do you know the number, Sophie?
Yes, I do.
Al-Zahani slid the phone over and dialed the country code.
Go ahead, Sophie. Call his office.
Jenkins and Fairchild, said the receptionist.
Can I talk to my dad?
Sophie said.
Who's your dad, sweetie?
John Summers. Oh, I'm sorry, he's not here. He doesn't work here anymore.
Where is he?
Sophie said through convulsive breaths.
I don't know, honey. He didn't tell me.
Sophie dropped the phone and ran out of the office to her bedroom. She slammed the door.